Welcome to The Apple of Truth, a podcast that, despite our original intentions, has grown into a pure Neil Gaiman appreciation.
So let us take you on a journey through everything Neil himself has ever written.
Currently, we are covering The Sandman and hope to enrich your dreams and haunt your nightmares.
I'm Lena.
And I'm Vero.
And today we are talking about Season 1, Episode 6, The Sound of Her Wings. And once again, there is a song with this name, two actually, but I am choosing to ignore one and focus on the other, which very fittingly is a piano piece by Greg Maroney from his album Felt Piano. Highly recommend you listen to it because it is beautiful.
Thank you for the recommendation. I have stopped bothering with this. I have written down another song that is in the episode yet again, and we can point it out when we get to it.
Will we? Because there is quite a bit in this episode. But before, what is this episode even about? And let's see if you can guess if I like this episode or not after my summary. Morpheus is being a moody little shit, so his big sister shows up to whip him back into shape. And once that is done, we get to meet his human BFF, or maybe even current love interest. Yes, I am shipping them. Shut up.
I wasn't gonna say anything to that because I am right there with you, especially in 1989. But I am getting ahead of myself.
Already in 1789.
Oh, I'm not saying there's nothing before that. I'm just saying, especially in the 20th century. But before we get to that, we need to talk about Thirsty Times. Because this episode was a bit of a roller coaster for me on that side. There was a lot of good material to work with this time.
And a lot of cringy hair.
I am in denial about the hair.
Seriously, some of those were...
I guess we'll cross that Nile Bridge when we come to it. Uh-huh. Now, my favorite depiction of Dream is 1889. It's the soft yellow light and Dream being infatuated by Hope and really enjoying the conversation until a certain point. It just really worked for me. And also that top hat, I don't know why, but somehow that worked for me so well.
So a top hat does it for you?
Apparently so.
No, I am in 1789.
No! No!
Yes, when Hob is defending Dream against Johanna's henchmen, and Dream is saying, "You need not have come for my defense."
That is cute, I'm not gonna lie.
No, that is hot. That is incredibly hot.
Okay, well, at least you didn't say 1689, because then I would have lost all respect for you. But we'll talk about that.
Little emo boy. Okay. This fact and puns will be long, so I will not be surprised if quite a good chunk of this lands in the bonus. If you want to hear the bonus, you need to be a Patreon on the Believer level. Come and join the dark side! We have finally a new director for this, and her name is Merzi Almas, and this is her only Sandman episode, but the name should ring a bell because she did direct two episodes of Lucifer, season 1 episode 11 and season 2 episode 3, and she also directed four episodes on Shadow and Bone.
Ooh! Oh wait, I felt like it sounded familiar. Love that.
The writer is Lauren Bello, who is one of our two story editors for this season, and I talked about her in detail in episode 1, so if you need a refresher, go and listen to that again. This is the highest rated episode of season 1 on IMDb with 9.2 stars. Every other episode is rated lower than this.
That doesn't surprise me, honestly.
And now let's get into the chunky bit. Several literary figures are depicted at the inn throughout the centuries, including William Shakespeare, Geoffrey Chaucer, and Christopher Marlowe. I missed the last one because I did not know that he was also known as Kit Marlowe.
Yeah, I love these little mentions kind of sprinkled throughout the episode. That was really fun.
In the original comics, the second soul Death visits is a struggling stand-up comedian who does a routine about Batman, who of course is a real person in the universe of the comics. This has been replaced with Sam, the swimmer who drowns. There was a White Horse pub on Poplar High Street, which is close to the location in Docklands, implied for the meeting place of Dreams and Hop. The pub was demolished in 2003, which approximately matches the timeline shown. Archaeological remains show that there was a history of brewing on that site going back continuously to medieval times. The pub was most famous for being run by two women in the 1740s who presented themselves as Mr. and Mrs. Howe.
Incredible. Love that.
This episode is a compilation of two briever issues from the Sandman comic book series. Issue number 8, The Sound of Her Wings, and issue 13, Man of Good Fortune. In comics and entertainment, a briever episode indicates a standalone storyline where characters may be influenced by events, but no part of the plot continues past the issue or episode. Thank you for the explanation, IMDb.
It's called a filler, thank you.
Yes. The penultimate pub scene discussions mirror the first pub discussion, Revolution, Poltex, and the joke, are you hunting for rabbits again? In the beginning, when Def and Dream are walking after the park, Def gets an apple and comments multiple times on how good it tastes and how much she likes apples. In the manga and anime Death Note, they also emphasize how much gods of death enjoy apples. And I actually do wonder if that is a coincidence, or if this was taken from something else. That is the reason why death gods like apples?
Well, it's clearly the apple of truth, so...
I mean, yes, the doy. Smoking in an English pub has been illegal since 1st of July 2007.
Thank you for that.
Hey, IMDb, okay? Americans don't know that. The black car that Hop is driving in 1989 is a Porsche 911 964 Cabriolet with Fox alloy wheels. This car was first produced in 1989, so it would have been brand new to the character, implying that he is again successful and rich. It is the first car that Porsche offered with the optional Tiptronic automatic gearbox and all-wheel drive. And then we have two anachronisms where... what we see doesn't match the actual year we are in. In the 1389 tavern, three men are seen with clay pipes, including Geoffrey Chaucer and the man sitting opposite Hop. None are actually smoking, although Hop's companion lights his pipe with a taper. This is 160 years before tobacco was introduced into Europe.
Yay! Progress!
Curiously, there is no sign of any tobacco used in the White Horse of later centuries until 1889 when Robert has a cigar in ashtray. The cigar remains unlit. Finally, in 1989, there were cigarettes and smoke, but no one is actually seen smoking.
Yes, because I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to put people actually smoking on the screen these days.
Which, whatever, but it's curious to me. And this concludes the facts and funs. Let's see how much of it actually made it into the episode.
You always say that, and then most of it does.
Depends all on you.
Well, now the next segment is very special. And I believe I have done this before when we were covering Lucifer, but it is not something that I do very often. So I did not write my previously on this time. I have let Dream to do it for me.
Oh.
And I'm going to do it in an accent because this reads as a voiceover for a trailer. So today... previously on Sandman. When they captured him, he just had one thought. Vengeance. It wasn't as satisfying as he expected. Meanwhile, his kingdom has fallen apart. His tools, long since stolen and scattered. So he embarked on a journey to find them, which he did. He's now more powerful than he's been in eons. And yet...
oh my god! I don't know if the clapping is gonna make it into the recording, but I love it! Oh my god!
I could not, honestly, because that speech, literally, I can hear a trailer, I can see a trailer of cut out short bits from the previous 5 episodes, and him doing the voiceover would have been even better, but I tried.
And you succeeded! Wow, I am very much here for it. I was not here for the episode in the beginning. It did take me a while to get into it. So there are quite a few complaints in the first, I think, 2 or 3 scenes.
Okay, well, let's start with my first complaint about this episode. And that is, please do not feed bread to birds. It is really, really bad for them.
Exactly. I have Morpheus feeding pigeons bread. He really should know better. Also, why does he have time to feed the birds? He has more important shit to do.
Clearly, he is a depressed boy with the smallest violin in the world.
He is such an emo boy this episode. It was so wild. Like, even more than usual.
I love the new character that we get introduced, though.
How long did it take you to realize who she is?
I think the moment when they start leaving the park and she tells Franklin that they will meet again, the way she phrased it, that was the last nail into the coffin. I did have a bit of a suspicion before, mainly because of the necklace that she's wearing.
The necklace is an ankh, which is an Egyptian symbol that you very well know. I instantly knew who she is because she looks exactly like the comics.
Oh, amazing. I love when that happens.
Outfit, jewelry, hair. This is taken from the page. This could not have been anyone aside from Death. And we did look into Death when we did Lucifer, and so I knew exactly what she looks like. Even without any of my Sandman knowledge, this I would have known from the first second we saw her.
Nice. I love Death. I love that they not once call her Death throughout the entire episode, but also I love that she is introducing us. This is the first endless, because I'm not counting Lucifer really.
Lucifer is not an endless.
Exactly. Basically, Death is the first endless besides Dream that we get to interact with on like higher level, essentially, on a little bit of a bigger time frame, let's put it that way. And one of the first thing that I noticed is that I kind of assumed, just based on how Dream presents himself, that they're all going to be speaking like archaic language and weird stuff and weird phrasing from the olden times because they're the endless and things around them change too fast and whatever. But she's a living fucking proof that that's not the case. And he chooses specifically to speak like that. And I find that very fun and funny.
He also chooses to keep himself a lot more separated from humanity than she did. And she goes into quite a bit of detail during the next few scenes. But first, she shows up, she sits next to him, and then she tries to quote Mary Poppins, but she does not do 100% correct quote, because I think she goes, "What do you get when you feed too much bread to birds?" And it is, "Feed the birds and what you got? Fat birds." So a bit of creative license there.
Yeah, she can afford it. She's an artist in a way. This is the point where she kind of challenges Dream to tell her what's wrong with him, because he clearly is not okay.
And he doesn't know what's wrong, and I had no patience for him. Were he a human, I would have patience.
If he was a human, I would have smacked him right in the face.
No, because obviously he's going through a depression, and that is okay. And it takes some time to sort through the fog in your brain and everything. But the thing is, it doesn't really matter what is wrong. He has work to do. He needs to fix shit. He doesn't have time to be depressed, literally.
I think that the way he phrased it at the end of last episode, it will be fixing itself. Just because he now has his power back. So the balance of power has been restored. Therefore, things will start fixing themselves.
So he is just going to leave all the humans that were affected by the sleeping sickness in the one way or the other, just as is. And he's not going to try to correct any of the prolonged effect, his imprisonment that he by choice made longer than it needed to be. Fuck that. I am so upset with Morpheus.
No, he's definitely gonna just do that. He's being very, very sorry for himself, and he goes through this big speech, which ended up being my previously on, obviously, because it needed to be done. And oh no, he had a true quest, and as I said, smallest violin ever. And then he ends it with, "There. You asked."
That also was the best moment of his QQ monologue, but him going, I had a purpose beyond my function. And I was like, dude, you still have a fucking purpose, which is fix shit. You can make the choice to fix shit.
I like that Death comes in with the correct attitude at this point, though.
When she goes like, "You sorry excuse for," what was it? Did you write it down?
"Stupidest, most self-centered excuse for anthropomorphic personification."
So good. So good.
Chef's kiss. Incredible. And he looks surprised when she goes off on him.
Which surprised me, because yes, he was imprisoned, but also they had eons together before that. And I'm pretty sure she did not go through a recent change of being the version of herself that she is right now.
I feel like she was the one calling him out on his bullshit their entire existence.
At least after she realized how to make her job in a way that actually gives her joy. So at this point, after she tells him off, I was like, I like her. And when she goes, "I have to go because I have work to do," I of course instantly went back into, "You also have work to do, fucking Morpheus." And then we do the leaving the park scene where we have Franklin hitting on Dev, asking for a number, and she's like, I'm gonna see you very soon. And I was like, aw, he's gonna die soon. I did not expect for him to die that quickly. Not gonna lie.
Same. I was like, enjoy life while you can, I guess.
Yeah.
Cue 2 hours later.
Carpe fucking diem. I think hora is the hour. So carpe fucking orem, whatever the accusative of hour is.
Now, as Morpheus and Death go for a little walk.
In matching goth outfits.
It's so good. I love their outfits. They have the same boots that we get a close-up on. I would love those boots. They look very good. They look very much like they will not die on you for years, which I appreciate. Durability is what I'm all about.
I literally wore Death's outfit when I was a goth.
Gasp. Shocking.
I didn't have an Ankh. I had a turned upside down cross because I was the true goth.
Yes, you are the true goth.
I was a very true goth back in the day. So obviously had to go that way. But yeah, those shoes, those pants, that tank top. Yep, that was me.
They straight from the beginning are defining their sibling relationships. There is a lot of very specific dynamics between the two of them that get introduced throughout the first scene as well. But specifically in this moment, it's the whole squabble about the apple, where she goes like, oh, I'm gonna get two, one for me and one for him. And he's like, no, I don't want one. I'm not hungry. And she's like, well, you can have it later. Come on. Just, and it feels like, come on, don't embarrass me in front of this nice man. Just have it. And she ends up getting the apple for free. And it's just very sweet interaction. I actually really, really enjoyed that.
And then she starts eating it and goes like, want a bite? Just one? And yeah, very much sibling energy.
She kind of tries to shove it into his face as well a little bit. It's just very cute. I love that interaction.
And from the beginning, we see that Death is basically a lot more human than Dream in all of her behaviorisms and the way she talks and the way she interacts with humans. So that from the get-go shows us that there is a huge difference between the two of them. And then, of course, throughout the next few scenes, we learn why and how this difference came to pass. We get information what Dream missed during his imprisonment, and he missed one family dinner, and I was like, the what now? The what now? What? A fucking family dinner? And the twins? Who are the twins? And if Desire is one of the twins, who's the other twin? And also, who and what is the prodigal?
You are asking exactly the same questions as I was.
And they just casually drop all of these bits, and I was like, what?
What just happened? See, this is how you do a exposition dump correctly. When we were in hell a couple episodes ago, that was so heavy with exposition. And it was just so tiring and daunting. It's just like, But this is also an information dump. And yet I'm sitting here on the tip of my seat trying to figure out, wait, you're giving me all of this information, but I don't have the context, so it's interesting to me.
Yeah, I have more questions and now I am more interested and intrigued in actually following the story, which I am very into it. And the moment I start getting interested, they do a distortion lens and I'm like, oh no. Oh no, there's fuckery to be had soon, because it is such a break from how the episode had been filmed up to this point, and it was so reminiscent of the previous 5 episodes. I was like, oh no, is this all there is? Is this all we get? Are we now going back into the depressing shit of the last 5 episodes? But thankfully, we don't. It gets sad, but not depressing.
Yes. Just before that happens, we talked about the relationship between Dream and Death, and you get to see how much he enjoys her company.
Yes, he's such a baby brother.
And how in fact he is lonely, and he misses them, all of them. Maybe not all of them, but he misses her.
Do you think he's the youngest of the Endless?
No, I know for a fact that he's not, because the Big D that we met last episode called him a big brother. So we know that there is at least one D.
True. Damn, I forgot that. Mm.
However, he doesn't give the youngest sibling energy. He's giving the middle child.
Oh, the constantly overlooked one? The me, I'm not getting enough attention? Or which part of the middle child are you talking about?
Kind of me, I'm not getting enough attention while also getting all the attention.
Yeah, I don't have a middle sibling. We were only two.
Be glad. I love my brother, by the way. Okay, I just want to put it on the record. My brother has grown into a very fine person, and I appreciate him.
Let's go inside the house right after the distortion lens and see what kind of fucky shit there is about to happen. And we get to hear a bit more of the beautiful violin music. Did you recognize the music before he says what it is?
I did not recognize the music. I was very distracted by the fact that the old man did not know how to play violin.
The actor, or...
Yeah, the actor.
Okay, I cannot comment on that, so I'm gonna leave that up to you.
I'm really sorry. This is my...
No, this is great!
I want to call it a pet peeve. This is one of my many, many pet peeves when I watch television, is every single time they play a string instrument, I pay attention to, first, are they playing what they are supposed to be playing or what we're hearing? And second, do they know how to even hold it in the first place? Because sometimes you have people who clearly know how to play the instrument, but they put soundtrack over them and it sounds wrong and it looks terribly because it's just they're playing something else.
It's out of sync, basically.
Yeah, completely. And it's really bothering me. And sometimes they just hire people who have no idea how to even hold the instrument, which is, at least do the homework. At least try to get the... It's not that difficult to get them at least to look somewhat competent and not just hold it like a little clutches and pull the bow half a meter above the strings, because that's just terrible. And it makes me angry, and I am currently feeling my little fists are a little... I feel like I want to hit something, because it's just, it's so simple. It is so simple. So many people know how to play these instruments.
So I'm gonna assume he did not know how to hold it right.
Yeah. I mean... They didn't do a wide enough shot for me to get really angry at it. But the little I saw, I don't think that the man was a violin player. Let's put it that way.
Well, at least he's dying, you know? So...
Karma's bitch.
Yep. Playing Schubert, who... If I remember correctly, never had any relevant success while alive and only got properly famous after dying?
It's very possible.
Because one of my favorite Austrian cabaret singers comments on the fact that Schubert never made any fame or money while being alive.
To be fair, he died when he was 31 years old, so...
Yes, so?
He didn't have a lot of time.
So...
I'm just saying, I love Schubert. Schubert was a great composer.
I do enjoy his music, but I'm not like especially partial to it. So Harry the violinist is playing Schubert, and he's playing an unfinished piece of music, which obviously is very fitting because Harry is dying. And I'm gonna say, I would not mind dying if death is the one to come and collect me. She is so sweet, she is so patient, she is so kind. I do appreciate that, you know?
I was feeling really sad for the whole thing. And then she kind of introduces her kindness and the way she talks to him and how reassuring she is. It made me feel a whole lot better. And I wasn't even in that situation. And I think it's done really, really well. I just read my note here. Oh no, this is so sad. And then with the same breath, not as sad as the old man pretending to play violin.
Priorities. He gets to say the Shema, which is a Jewish prayer that serves as a centerpiece of the morning and evening prayer in Jewish prayer services. And basically, it is more or less what he says later on in English. It is obviously a bit more, but if you want to look it up, you can literally just Google the Shema. There's a Wikipedia page, and then there you get the whole shebang. And Morpheus moves over into another room to look at a picture of four people, and I thought that the picture was going to be so important and nothing ever comes of it, so I don't really understand why Morpheus was so interested in it. But because he has the focus in the front, in the back, we see the shadow and the sound of death unfolding her wings. And it is so beautiful. I appreciate that we do not see her actual wings, because it kind of creates this mystique that you only see her wings when you are actually dying.
About the photograph, it is a string quartet, and I was curious if there's going to be some reference to the comics, but apparently, since it wasn't on IMDb and I don't know any of the comics, I can't tell, so I'm assuming no. I think that the way Dream interacts with it is more about looking at the old man's dreams when he was in his prime and feeling the loss. So I think that it's not as much about the photograph as the emotion that it creates for Dream. Because he knows who he is. He knows his life, as he knows everyone's life and dreams.
He knows literally everyone, which to me makes it so much harder to understand how he can relate so little with humanity on a whole.
I think that it brings us down to the moment, which we shall not speak too much about, where he involved himself and he got hurt. And ever since then, he wouldn't allow himself to connect.
Are you talking about his girlfriend or are you talking about Hob?
No, I'm talking about his girlfriend.
But he didn't allow himself to be hurt. He allowed himself to become obsessed, which is something very different.
Yes, but that's not how he sees it, I don't think.
Why are men?
Well, that is a whole other debate.
So we leave Harry's house and we go back to walking, and we are walking up to Sam, which is the swimmer. So we have the whole conversation and he tells her that they were hunting for her, and she goes that she knew, which kind of makes it even more difficult for me to accept that she never tried to help him. Because if she knew that they were gunning for her, how would she not go out of her way to help him when he had been caught in her place? And I am not quite satisfied that we do not get any kind of information on that.
Yeah, I don't love how blasé she is about that. And then she just moves past it by taking off her shoes.
Because isn't it in the beginning with the him not asking for help and, oh, I didn't want to bother you and anything? It's like, girl, you knew. You knew that he was in prison. You knew that he was in trouble. And you knew that he was in prison in your place. Why does he have to be the one to ask for help?
I think that she also knows Dream very, very well. And I feel like she knows that he wouldn't probably take it well because he's very proud if somebody else shows up.
But he does take issue that no one cared, apparently, that no one showed up.
But he takes issue after the fact.
Yeah. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't be offended that no one showed up to help and also be like, oh, if anyone had showed up, I would have been hurt in my fragile ego.
I think that was part of the reason. But also, I'm glad that she didn't, because if she would have showed up, it would have created an opportunity for Roderick to try to capture her.
So she could have shown up after collecting Roderick. She must have been there to collect Roderick.
That's true. Oh my God. Oh.
Yeah, hence my issue. She fucking collected Roderick and then didn't do a thing.
Wait, didn't Roderick die at the dome in the basement?
Yeah.
So she was there and Dream didn't see her because she chose to be invisible to him?
Most likely. Which, oh, fucked up.
That's things that must have made him even more resentful.
He also must have realized that she collected Roderick because she collects them all. So, yeah, I did not take this well. But we quickly go past that because she starts taking her shoes off because it's great to be barefoot because you're really connected to the earth. And because I'm a petty bitch, I'm like, honey, you're on a bridge, not on the earth.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. But then she actually walks on the earth barefoot. So I was like, okay, I'll let it go.
Still, it was hilarious to me. And obviously Morpheus does not take off his shoes.
Of course not, because he's still holding back. She is connected to humanity. She is connected to the earth. And he still refuses to let go.
I mean, can you imagine Morpheus being barefoot?
It's a little scary.
Yeah, it would be weird. Like, I don't know, an error in the Matrix or something.
I mean, she is touching grass.
Oh, wow. Wow, okay. We collect Sam, and despite knowing that she is literally deaf and that the only reason for her to actively interact with humans means that they are dying, all of this still came as a surprise to me. It was so quick, and with the wife in the background and everything, and Sam trying to bargain that he just needs to give her the code so she can access the travel documents, which is like such a mundane thing, but it feels very human to hyper-focus in that moment on something completely irrelevant. It was very authentic to me.
Yeah, it was very good. I really loved the scene. It is interesting though, because she allows Harry to say the prayer.
Ha, see, I think Harry was already dead when he said the prayer.
Oh, but he put down his violin.
Yeah, I don't think that was human Harry. I think that was ghost Harry, basically.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me. It's actually a good point.
I'm pretty sure the moment you see her, you are already dead. Because Franklin later on sees her properly after we hear the crash. And so I'm pretty sure all of her interactions are after the fact. That even if she wanted to, she would not be able to put them back into their bodies. Basically, once she lets them reach this stage, they're gone.
Nope, this makes absolute sense to me.
But now we go into another walking scene and we have name drops. Most importantly for me in that moment, we get Mad Hattie name drop as an example of humans who do not die, who do not get collected by her. And so I was like, Mad Hattie, Mad Hattie, what? Tell me more. But sadly, we instantly move on to Hob Gatling. And I was like, who? Because I was not familiar with that name. I did not read that story in the comics. And I had not come across him in previous Lucifer/Sandman research.
I was very intrigued because I, of course, remember nothing and know nothing. So they started dropping names. And I was like, ooh, special project. Dream has a special project. This cannot be a human being because that so does not track for him. And I was proven wrong.
But also, who would have seen this coming? But another really important thing in this moment is that Death in this scene acknowledges that she has thought, or that she had in the past thought about quitting. And I'm curious what that would have meant. Because with Dream quitting against his will, there were no dreams and there were no nightmares, and it affected people to the point where they never woke up or where they couldn't sleep. And so I do wonder if Death ever actually did quit. Does that mean that people would still die, but specters would roam the earth? Would people not die at all anymore? Like, where is the line? What exactly does she cause, and what exactly would not be able to happen anymore if she ever quit? And so I want to put that on the list for Neil, comparing Dream unwillingly quitting, what would be the equivalent with Death quitting?
I agree. I had very similar questions here. I wonder if walking out willingly would change the balance a little bit, so she would be replaced by somebody.
Another good question.
Because it makes sense to me that Dream being taken unwillingly and wanting to be in the job, there wasn't a replacement.
Yeah, good question. We're going to put that as the addendum. Also, I don't remember if it was this or the next walking scene where she says that she was there the moment the first living thing was there, and when the last breath has been breathed, she will be there to put up the chairs before exiting the universe.
And turn off the lights and lock the universe behind her.
Which is simply a more poetic way of the same statement that we had with Death in Supernatural. I existed long before God, and I will be there to reap his soul, and I will exist long after him. So it was very nice for me to have like this Death being the always there thing.
It feels lonely when you think about it.
Yeah, and she used to be lonely until she realized that she wasn't lonely, which is like the final thing we get before Dream is left alone. But first, we have an actual devastating scene, because as little as I do like children, I don't think there's anything more devastating than sudden infant death syndrome. Because there is nothing you can do.
My first thought here when they walked into the house and I saw the mom with the baby was that the mom is going.
For me, it was obviously, it was so clear it was going to be the baby.
I think it was more of a wish at that point.
It made sense to me because we get the parallel. We get the grandpa, we get the young one, we get the baby, and we get another young one.
I mean, I realized that very quickly, but when they first walked into the house, I saw the mom with the baby, and I thought to myself, oh no, poor baby is going to be there left by themselves with a dead mother next to their crib. That's going to be traumatic. And then it dawned on me that she's not there for the mom. I'm like, I don't know which one is worse, honestly.
I think this one is worse, because from what I know about people who did lose children, there is always this huge amount of guilt of blaming yourself. Like, basically, what could you have done different? Because especially babies are like completely in your charge. So that scene was so much worse than any of the other death scenes. But also the way Death talks to the baby, obviously able to communicate with the baby. Yeah, that's it. That is all you get. Which is like, You know?
I want to know if reincarnation is a thing in this universe, because it seems a little unfair to have a soul on Earth for weeks and then they are already sent away.
I mean, it is a thing in our world, so...
I believe in reincarnation.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I mean, I don't think that it's a specific belief system, but I believe in energy and humans are alive with certain life energy, and I don't think that goes away. I think that just moves somewhere else.
Okay.
Things you learn about me after 4 years of doing this.
I don't think you ever talked about this.
I don't talk about it a lot, actually. It's interesting. I used to talk about it more, but I don't know why. It just never comes up these days.
We talked a lot about dying and souls and everything on Lucifer, but this came never up. Because I am very clear on my there is nothing except energy in the brain. It's all electricity. There is no soul. And I have always been very clear on that. But the question if reincarnation is a thing in the Sandman universe is a good question, and so we definitely should put that on the list. So we leave that mom and we hear her realizing that the baby is dead in the background.
It's heartbreaking.
And we get a voiceover, and Dream, in his very dispassionate way, talking about humanity and how we handle dying, and him not understanding why humans are so afraid to die, but so ecstatic to be born, because it is as natural to die as it is to be born. But if you don't exist before you were born, and you don't know if you're going to exist, or if you're not aware of your existence before you were born, and you don't know if you're going to exist after you're dying, it is completely logical to me that coming into existence is a cause of joy, and leaving your existence is horrifying.
I think this is one of the reasons why he doesn't understand humanity. The fact that he wonders about it on this level. Because I too wonder about humanity sometimes, same Dream. But in this aspect, it feels very logical to me that the way you described it is very precise. There's not much to add there, but the fact that he doesn't get that is part of the reason why he is where he is right now, why he's going through what he's going through. He just doesn't have the connection with people or Earth or anything besides himself, essentially.
And maybe a bit of his siblings, but since his siblings are endless, they have no end and no beginning.
But we know for a fact that he distances himself from his siblings as well.
Well, not from his sister as much, obviously. And apparently he did come to previous family dinners. We don't know how often they happen.
Yeah, that is true. But they end up collecting all of these souls, and it is very sad watching this, but it's also very beautiful because you see Death's face and the way she talked about how important it is to have a kind face and somebody to hold their hand.
And a kind word. A kind face and a kind word.
It's beautiful to see this death montage, as funny as it sounds, because you see her work and you see her job and you see that she loves doing it, which brings us to the following scene back in the park where they're walking through the alleyway. We get spelled out what we get to see just before that. The only reason we exist, you and I, and desire and despair and the whole family, is to serve them. We are here to do a job. It is our purpose. It is our function. We are here for them.
But she literally is saying our purpose is our function. So she is answering the initial complaint or whining of Morpheus with the he used to have a purpose beyond his function, and now we get the answer, your purpose is your function. And also she is making a very clear point that she is not doing it by herself, that she is doing it with the humans, that she is not alone at the end of the road.
Yeah, and neither are they.
And so this is a very healthy way to look at it. And as much as I get her point, I do understand wanting to be more, or rather not just wanting, but needing to be more than just your function, even or especially when your only purpose is your function. I can understand that Dream feels like he needs to be more, because she already is more than just her function, because she has made the connection, as you said, with humanity and humans every single time she collects a soul. And because he is missing that connection, he is reduced to just his function as a purpose. And if he had the connection, I don't think he would be as limited in his purpose. But because he is missing the connection, it does not feel enough. And so I understand him wanting to be more.
You are wording things so well today.
Because I really like the episode, so I'm not distracted by complaining.
But Death says now that she needs to collect this one last soul and then get back because she's done for the day.
Which, hilarious, because I'm pretty sure there's more people dying.
I know, timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly.
Yes, she definitely lives in the dot of the eye in Jeremy Baramy.
Yes, but Dream says that he needs to also move on because he has an appointment that he's late for. And I was like, oh, there's something from earlier that we heard about an appointment that we might see. Woo! So I was very excited for him to embrace that. And I was very curious where this is going to go.
And so we see Death collecting Franklin and Dream walking off by himself. And while we have him walking off, we get a kind of slow-mo. And people do look at him while he walks through throngs of people. And I do wonder how other people see Dream, because we got the example in Hell where his not actually ex-girlfriend saw him very differently. How does that work?
Yeah, because the guy that was coming out of the store looked a little scared.
Yeah, and then the other just looked a bit confused. So it was like, okay, what are these people seeing? And also, what would you and I see, basically?
I would love to know that. After that, he finally makes it to the inn.
To an abandoned building, which I was like, great start. I did not see it coming that we were getting a proper time jump. And of course, once we had the 100 years, it was clear we were going to go through all the 100 year moments. But I did not see it coming that we are now going to 1389.
And as we slide into 1389, we see the worst wig of the episode.
The morphing. Oh.
I loved the scene transitions, but this one bothered me because the hair was just...
All of it was bad.
I just couldn't deal with this one. This one was so distracting, and like with the outfit and everything, it just did not work on Tom Sturridge. It did not work on him. And I don't know if it's the wig department or if it's just him or what happened there.
The only saving grace thing about this is that this is a cut within the episode, because this transition took me out of the episode, but because this is basically two episodes in one, it didn't matter that we are now having to come back into a new episode, basically. So that made it not be too bad. And instantly I was very curious because Death and Dream are back together here. And he is talking that he had just met with a delegation of fairy and they are considering abandoning this realm altogether. And obviously I am obsessed with anything relating to the she. So tell me more about the fairy in The Sandman.
There's so many questions from this episode. I love that we get Death looking out for Dream.
Very big sister, classic.
Specifically in this moment, it's very important for his future development that she tries to humanize humanity to him, essentially.
She basically goads him into going up to a human and making a bet that the human does not even realize he's agreeing to. But without her poking and messing with Dream, this would never have come to pass.
There is a couple of details of this specific scene that I really enjoyed. First of all, Death is wearing her same necklace, but Dream is also wearing a necklace, which is an hourglass, which makes complete sense to me, obviously.
I did not clock that. Nice detail work.
Lol, clock that. But I noticed that there was something around his neck, but it only connected properly when I was rewatching it and making the notes because of the specific items that we get at the last scene. So each of them, I feel like, have to have some sort of a symbol for themselves. But we'll get to that one because I have questions about that. While here, I just noticed that they both were wearing quite big pendants around their necks. And as much as Death is wearing it still in present, Dream does not, and I'm pretty sure he loses it fairly quickly. I think this might be the only scene where he actually wears the hourglass still. So curious about why he left that behind. Why doesn't he wear it anymore?
I have an idea. Maybe the sand from the hourglass then got put into the pouch.
Oh, so he changed his items of power?
Yes.
Why?
Because he's being dramatic.
That sounds like him.
And there has to be an origin of the Sandman putting sand into kids' eyes when they fall asleep.
Of course. That makes complete sense. We could have just stopped by saying he's just being a drama queen. But another very good moment in this scene that I want to point out is that when we start hearing the voice in the background saying, I have met death and I just choose not to die. I'll be the first one. And going on and on and on, Dream has the biggest eye roll in history of eye rolls. It's so funny to me.
Morpheus is so annoyed and so disgusted the entire time. But I have been shitting on Tom Sturridge's non-visual acting a lot. And I take back everything I said. Because, yes, in the last 5 episodes, Dream had exactly 1 facial expression. And that was it.
That's not true.
Yes, it is. And then this episode, finally, we get the full range of acting that shows us that not only does Tom Sturridge have more than 1 facial expression, he actually is an absolutely incredible actor.
True that. He is very good with micro expressions. And I have said this in episode 2.
There were none.
That's not true. I have read a lot of emotions. The fact that you didn't see them doesn't mean they weren't in it.
Of course, if I don't see them, they don't exist. Have you met me?
So does it mean that if I turn my camera off, I do not no longer exist?
No, because I've met you, so I already know that you exist.
Well, what if that all was a dream?
Mm-hmm.
All 4 years, almost 5 years, you've been in a coma and I actually don't exist.
Yes.
Anyway, back to the Sandman. Thank you very much.
Sorry. Come on, you need some bonus material.
Ah, it's true.
So, before we can talk about what actually happens in this scene, we need to mention that this is the scene that they had Geoffrey Chaucer in. So, in the beginning, 2 people are talking and one dude is calling the other Geoffrey, and that is Geoffrey Chaucer. And I want to point this out because the casting of both Geoffrey Chaucer and Kit Marlowe is surprisingly perfect. Like, when you look at renderings, what they look like and who they cast for them. Fucking perfection. I do not see it for William Shakespeare, I have to say, at all.
I can see it. I was just going to say, because we only see a specific image when it comes to William Shakespeare. And this is supposed to be a very young version of that. So I can see it.
I didn't do my homework for the actors. Did you recognize Steph?
Yes, but I don't know where from because I forgot to look it up.
The Good Place. It's Simone.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, wow. Sorry. I didn't do my homework, so I was like, I'm gonna sneak that in. Yeah, she was Simone in Good Place. Chidi's girlfriend.
I knew I remembered her smile.
So, shame on me. Okay, sorry. So I pointed out Geoffrey Chaucer, and then, of course, we get the bet, and we have a date. Every 100 years, we meet in this pub.
Every 100 years, Dream goes on a date with Hop.
And when they agree on a date, Morpheus looks so arrogant and so mean.
He's so self-obsessed at this point. It's so funny to me.
He's such a dick. It is wild. Also, is he wearing eyeliner?
Oh, 100%. Very, very, very heavy on eyeliner the entire episode.
And I think, I don't remember which year, but at one of those, he's also wearing mascara. I'm pretty sure it's the next year. In 100 years, he is also wearing mascara. So it was like, oh my God, emo boy went full emo boy.
Yeah. I love that they call Hobbsy at the end of this scene. And then we get the beautiful transition into 1489.
So my biggest question was if Hop was going to age. Because this is what is going to make all the difference to me. Because if he were to age, then yes, he would be begging for death very quickly. But if he maintained the good health that he had all along, and if not being able to die also meant not catching any sickness or something like that, then being rid of all physical sufferings, aside from hunger, obviously, as we later learn, then I was not surprised that he is enjoying life fully.
We do hear, though, that he can get hurt.
Yeah, he can get hurt and that he can be hungry and everything, but apparently he can't age and he can't die of sickness or anything, you know?
I think he can still get sick and he can go through all of the symptoms and everything, but he just doesn't die at the end of it. So I think this is even worse.
So at the end, when you have a deathly illness, do you then just like go to the end and then you wake up and you're fine again?
You just get better eventually. But we don't know the timeline on that because at certain point, death comes for you when it comes to specific illness. So for example, let's say he has cancer and he has a brain tumor and he's seeing things.
Does the cancer just eat all of his brain and then once it has eaten everything, it vanishes? Because you do not get better with certain types of cancer. So I want to... This is not a question we can answer, so I want to actually put this on the question list.
A lot of questions this episode.
He can get hurt. So what happens if you cut off his hand? Does it grow back? What happens if you cut off his head?
Because this was exactly my question. When he becomes homeless and a couple of centuries later, he's brought in and he has been hungry and everything, and still he has perfect teeth. How does that work?
Yeah, to me that was more lazy costume design, but how did his stomach not digest itself, you know? How can he now still eat?
But this is all the same principle. If he just gets better, if things regrow after they are destroyed by disease or a humanity thing, how does that work? How long does it take? What does he have to do? Does it just show up overnight? Does all of his teeth fall out and then the next morning he wakes up in the same condition he was when Death and Dream made the bet in the first place? Who is doing this?
How does it work? Lots of questions.
I feel like we are starting to learn a little bit about Hobbes's personality already in 1489, because a lot of people would take this as a blank check, essentially, that they can do whatever they want and there will not be any consequences. But he seems to be genuinely enjoying the human progress and watching things around him, especially at this part.
He's so into it.
Yeah. So I feel like they couldn't have chosen a better person to put through this. Because, yes, he makes mistakes and we will learn more about them throughout the time. But ultimately, he is really interested in humanity and in progress and things like that. And he is keeping up with life and everything. So it's really interesting that they managed to somehow randomly come across a person like that.
He believes in the potential of humanity and is willing to always embrace progress, and those two abilities are what enable him to adjust through the changes of the time.
Because that's another thing, if you don't evolve with the times, which a lot of people would be like, I like my old ways, you will not survive. In a way, you know, you will be drowned in a fucking lake. You will not die, but, you know, you will never be able to be a part of the society at some point. We've seen this in big stories like fucking Dracula or whatever, where they just get stuck in their own ways and they don't embrace the progress around them. And even though they are endless, or, you know, it's a really good parallel to Dream. Because Dream has not been evolving with humanity. He has been very much stuck in his own ways, and now it's biting him in the butt.
And so I don't think that they got super lucky with finding like a good person. I don't think Hop inherently is a good person, but because he is willing to embrace both the growth of humanity and the growth of himself, he is one to not squander all the potential that he has. But also he has enough time to like basically go through a lot of trial and error. That is also something to not be discounted, because 100 years is a lot of time, like a lot of time. And so we have the sitting down Hop gushing on about how amazing it is to be alive and that he got into something called printing, which definitely is not going to take off and it's hard work, but he enjoys it. So yay. I was like, okay. And then we go fast forward to the next 100 years, and obviously once again we get new hair, this time eyeliner again, but no mascara, because I was very obsessed with the mascara.
I am obsessed with this outfit.
Okay, sure.
So we get finally, for the first time since this terrible thing happened, Tom's actual hair, first of all. So it looks a lot more acceptable to me. But holy shit, like the leather and everything and the fit, this was a big contender for me.
I got distracted because Kit Marlowe is hot.
Of course you got distracted by that.
And Hop changed his name. This is the year where we meet Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is having a conversation with Kit. And I get distracted by Kit because Kit is hot. And we also learned that Hop now has a new name and he goes by Sir Robert Gatlin. And Hop is not only enjoying life, but he is now also capitalizing on everything. He has made a name for himself, literally. He has made a fortune. He is on the top of his game and he is starting to be arrogant about it. So it did not come as a surprise to me when in the next date, he has lost it all. Like, that was very obvious to me because Hop had been on this constant way up and it had to fail at some point. But Dream is not even interested because he is distracted as well, not by Kit, but by Will Shakespeare.
I feel like the way Sir Hop is presenting himself is very greedy. It's very cocky, careless, and it feels like he has it all. So he has no more dreams. He is not interesting to Dream. Why would he? While when you have something or someone, rather, like Will Shakespeare over there talking about how he wishes to be able to give people dreams long after he's gone, that's something that strikes a chord with Dream.
I mean, literally, Will said the word dream and Morpheus was like, "You what?"
Somebody called?
He probably only heard the iambic pentameter and then he got instantly drawn in and was like, "Yo, dude, I hear this. So keep talking like this and also start writing like this because this needs to be a thing."
Did you notice that every single one of them is wearing an earring in this scene?
No. So we replaced mascara with gay earrings. Okay. This entire episode, or this entire second part of the episode, is so gay to me. I love it.
It's incredible. So Hop is wearing a black little ring and Will and Dream are both wearing a silver tiny little ring. I only noticed it on the second go because I noticed Hop's earring straight away, but I didn't notice the other two.
Was it a fashion thing?
Shakespeare is, I'm pretty sure, portrayed with an earring, if I remember correctly.
Was it a fashion thing back in 1589?
I'm pretty sure it was, because Shakespeare is wearing earrings on every single portrait that you can find.
I love details like that.
I know. And I think that it just worked with the outfit that Dream was wearing so fucking well. I was so there for it.
At this point in the scene, I had not found my hottest Dream moment, so I was also like paying attention to how hot or not hot Dream was. And I end this scene with, now Dream is hot because he doesn't look like he just smelled a pile of shit. Because when he's busy with Will Shakespeare, he looks interested. And before that, he always looked so disgusted that he was simply horrifying to look at to me, you know?
Now, we are about to go into something where I lost my fucking mind.
Yes, and wonder why. Because we got the long hair back in 1689.
But it's not just the long hair.
He looks like a vampire. He looks like a fucking vampire.
I'm getting the biggest Twilight flashbacks. If you Google the fucking, Voltari, whatever, the one that Michael Sheen's brother on the, you know, Michael Sheen plays a vampire on Twilight, you know that, right? So there's a guy who plays his brother and he literally has the exact same look. The long, sleek black hair and the white face. And I just saw this and I completely lost my mind and did not pay attention to anything else for the rest of the scene because I was just like, what is this? Why is he looking like a vampire? What is going on? Is this a look he's going for? Why is he looking for this look? Completely lost. You lost me there. Why? Why?
Do not ask me. I do not know. So he's sitting there very regal, which just adds to the vampire impression. And Hop fights his way in, gets nearly thrown out, and Morpheus, "Here's my guest."
Which is also very vampire-like.
Yes. And so Hop is there, he starts eating, and Dream is like, very obviously like, okay, this might be it. Like, you can feel the anticipation coming off of him in waves. And then Hop goes, "Nowhere to go but up." And 80 years of suffering, Hop describes. And you can see Dream actually tearing up a bit. And for a second there, I thought, oh no, he's relating to Hop. And I realized, no, he's tearing up because he thinks he wins the bet right here. Because Hop surely must now finally have the point where he's like, I'm done with life. Because he gets so offended when Hop says, of course I still want to live.
I can see where you're coming from, but I disagree with you. I think that it stopped being about the bet for Morpheus 200 years ago.
No, in 100 years it's when it stops.
No, this is the interaction where I feel like it stops being about the bet. Because 200 years ago, this is the first time they meet. He is interested. He wants to know. He's surprised. He's intrigued. Second interaction, he's like, ugh, I'm bored with this now. Third interaction, I'm still curious, but this is probably going to be the last time we see each other because of that. Oh, it's not. And now I'm interested in you as a human being.
Yeah, but that is something that is going to start processing through his brain. And then when we meet in 100 years, this will have moved to be something different than just a bet. But we see him tearing up before Hop says that he still wants to live.
I think that he genuinely feels for him because not only Hop lost his fortune, but most importantly, he lost his family. And this is something that we've all obviously seen coming because...
Because they don't live forever.
Exactly. But the way he loses them, it's not like we had a full life and then they passed away.
No, she died at childbirth, which also was incredibly obvious was gonna happen.
Well, yes, but that doesn't mean it's not sad.
Of course, but... It was the least surprising thing about the entire episode to me.
I don't think it was surprising. I just think that Dream genuinely feels the emotion.
And that's the thing. I don't think he does. I don't think there is any genuine emotion until after this interaction, because I think this is the point where it starts changing. Because up to this point, whenever they met, Hop had a very decent and easy life. And Morpheus's assumption was that sooner rather than later, a human will literally beg for death because life is going to be so hard. And Hop just kept proving him wrong, but also kept proving that life didn't have to be hard. So Morpheus' initial claim never got disproven because Hop never went through the suffering, quotation marks. And now that he went through 80 years of suffering, which is a fucking long time, basically instantly after they met the last time, it all fell apart. And still, he has this passion for life. And I think this is the moment where Morpheus has to start to consider that he might be wrong. And only once he has to start considering that he might be wrong, he can actually start caring. I am with everything that you said in the next meeting, not this one. Because this is where it starts, not where it's already there.
We are allowed to see things slightly different.
I mean, first episode, we're not fighting, so yay. Who do you think is drawing that picture?
I don't know. Is it somebody specific?
No, but I was so curious because how, after 3 meetings, does it already turn into an urban myth that holds up well enough that someone would be interested enough to paint them and then maintain or safeguard this picture for another 100 years so Joanna Constantine can get her fucking hands on it? So I was very curious, like, was this a random happenstance? Did someone orchestrate this? Because at the very end, we do learn of this episode that someone orchestrated the entire imprisonment of Dream. So now I'm being paranoid and I'm like, who dis and why?
To me, this was just a random thing. To me, it was just a random cartoonist or artist that just happened to portray them and it just grew into this myth.
Because we're both not native speakers, I'm pretty sure Hob is the one who says a mug's game. Were you familiar with that expression? Do you know what a mug's game is?
I understood it in the context.
Basically, it's a foolish endeavor because I had never heard the expression a mug's game.
I know that I heard it as something not common to my ear, but I understood it in the context.
Yeah, in the context, it was like, okay, I get more or less what you mean, but like basically fuck around, find out. Would be the modern version.
Well, speaking of the drawing, that gives us a beautiful, another excellent transition to the next scene. Because we see the drawing being signed and then aged and taken off the camera, and we are in front of the inn with a mysterious lady with a hood on and 2 what I only assumed at that point were soldiers.
Yeah, it was very clear there were like the muscle.
Yes, but to me at that point I was like, is somebody going to arrest them? Because that's the vibe that I was getting from the 2 of them being behind the lady. Couldn't tell you why.
We're back inside and we instantly learn that Hob is more careful now because now he has several exit plans. He has money stashed away in several countries. So he will never go back to the horrible position he was in back in 1689.
learning from his mistakes.
Because he grows and it is really, really good. But he did make some of his money in a not great way. And Dream, who still looks like a fucking vampire in this, takes offense at Hop being active in slavery. And I was very surprised at this. Why does Dream take offense at slavery when he doesn't care about humanity? To be really crass, I would expect the dreams of people who are imprisoned to be even richer than the ones who are free because they have more need for it, you know?
It's more, I suppose, he maybe tries to compensate for them then, tries to give them richer dreams because the reality is so terrible. But I am very happy with what he's doing there because I feel like he's a very strong believer in, for lack of a better word, free will. And I think that he gets agitated if the option of choice is taken away from anybody, be it himself or any of his siblings or any of the angels or whomever, or be it a human being. And if he is giving somebody the luxury of choice, and he says it here, he is giving a suggestion, he doesn't tell him what to do, and Hop gets a bit defensive about this, obviously. And ultimately, Dream says, the choice is yours. Would you take away the choice from others? I think it's more about that and the choice itself than the humans themselves.
Mm. I just feel like there's no precedence for this, so it did feel like it came out of nowhere for me.
You have to create the precedent somewhere. We are in the 18th century now, so.
Yeah.
This is the precedence we will be building on later, let's put it that way.
Yeah, maybe. Then we have the conversation about King Lear with the happy ending for King Lear. If you want to know more, listen to the facts and funs that might have made it into the episode or maybe the bonus. Become a Patreon. And then when we talk about King Lear, this is another of my runner-up moments for Dream being hot, because when he remembers Shakespeare, he once again loses his permanently disgusted facial expression and he looks hot. Basically, whenever it doesn't look like someone was holding like a turd under his nose, he looks hot.
The fact that you keep describing his, to me, hot face.
No, when he looks so disgusted and annoyed, he's not hot.
That's not true. He doesn't look disgusted and annoyed absolute majority of this episode. I don't know what you're talking about.
This is the last time he does it.
Nor he did look disgusted or annoyed most of the time in the previous 5 episodes, if I may say so myself.
Yes, he's so fed up with humanity most of the time. He looks exasperated.
Yes, but that's not like smelling shit, is it?
It's the only way I can describe it accurately enough. Because he always has like this slight turn up of the nose and the slight downturning of the sides of the mouth. And to me, that is the, I'm smelling something unpleasant, you know? Which is why that is my go-to description. And I do agree that there are moments where he looks hot. Basically, every single time his face relaxes.
There's no point in talking to you about this because it's the same thing over and over and over again. So let's not.
Speaking of the same thing, enter Joanna Constantine.
Were you surprised to see her?
No.
It made sense to me for her to be there, but I was surprised to see her.
I was like, literally the only character we potentially could have met, the only one I would have liked to see more here would have been Mad Hattie, just to have a backstory for Mad Hattie. But for a moment, I wasn't sure if this was our Joanna or ancestor, like great-grandma Joanna or something.
To me, it was very obvious because she has a different voice.
See, I don't clock those things.
Her pitch and her accent was slightly different to what we have seen with our Joanna.
I mean, it could have been because she aged 250 years, you know?
Yes, but to me, it was very obvious differentiation. So I didn't even think of that being the same one. However, the second Joanna shows up, just before that happens, Hop asks Dream who he is. And Dream, to me, feels like he might answer. And I wonder if he would have answered and what would he say if he had the option. Because unfortunately for me, Joanna cuts in and doesn't give him the opportunity to say anything. But I am curious. I am very curious what he would have replied. Because I feel like he's, at this point, intrigued enough and enjoys spending time with Hop enough to maybe be a little bit more honest than he would have been like 100, 200 years ago.
I think he would have given him something, but not the full truth. I don't think he would have told him that he is Dream or Lord of the Dreams or whatever. He might have given him Morpheus.
Because they're on a first name basis?
Yeah, and then basically leave Hob to figure it out himself until the next date to then be confirmed in, okay, this is a smart human.
Yeah, playing games, huh?
Yeah, of course. I mean, come on, that's how the queers do flirt.
Do be flirt.
Yes, I mean, we do not know another way than to be awkward and weird. But Joanna shows up and she interrupts them and she says, "The devil and the wandering Jew." And I lost my shit when Morpheus goes, "I am no devil." And Hop goes, "And I am not Jewish." That was so funny.
It's excellent. It's really, really good.
I seriously sat here and I was fucking laughing because the pitch of the delivery for both of them is so different, with Morpheus being his usual, "I am no devil," and Hop having all of his joie de vivre with the tea. So yeah, I was so here for it. Ah, they're such a good pair.
There is a bit of a conversation back and forth, and Joanna demands for them to join her in her carriage. And Dream just says, "No." And she's like, "Okay, well, this is why I have the muscle here." So she just steps to the side and the boys are about to take over with their little daggers. And before anything can happen, holy shit, Hop can fight.
Which, not surprising after 400 years and at least 80 of those on the streets. And he did say that he was a soldier in the beginning, so it made sense. And this obviously is the moment I started explicitly shipping them, because Dream turns off Joanna by blowing sand into her eyes. And I was like, oh my god, did he drive her mad? Well, who cares? Because Dream looks at Hop and goes, "You need not have come for my defense." And I was like, okay, yes. Please, do come for his defense every single time. Because, yes, I need this. And now kiss.
There's this whole thing that the entire time we are in these flashbacks, Dream is being a mysterious stranger and everything. And not once we have his theme tune playing until this point.
Ooh, I did not pay attention to that.
When he reveals his power to Hop by blowing the sand into Joanna's eyes, we get a thrum, thrum, thrum. And it's just kind of, ooh, finishes that scene with a cherry on top. It's incredible. And then there's this amazing moment when Hop is like, "Oh, let's go to another pub. What do you think?" And Dream goes like, "Well, I think we need to be more careful because she may have given this description to multiple places." And he's like, "Well, it's fine. I can't die." And Dream goes, "Well, but you can be hurt or captured." And I'm like, wait, why do you care that if he can be hurt or captured? Do you not want him to be hurt or captured? That is interesting. Why do you care?
Exactly.
Tell me more, baby.
So basically, from the moment he says, "You need not have come for my defense," every single sentence is a confirmation that they are in love. Period.
100%. That's totally happening.
Yeah. And don't at me. I don't care. I know I'm right. Anything else for this scene from you?
No, that's me.
Because when Hop comments on what you did to her with Joanna, Dream says that she has old ghosts. And I just am curious if there's any more information. So potentially this would be another question if there is more backstory on old Joanna and her ghosts.
/ nightmares.
Yep. So just curious if there is any other information and if there maybe is a comic or something. But now we go into 1889 and I'm not ready.
From the first second, I knew I was going to love this outfit. So I saw the silhouette on the street and I was like, this is going to work for me.
What does he remind you of in this scene? Because he gave me one very specific vibe. Style-wise, hair-wise, outfit-wise, body language-wise, everything.
I don't think he reminds me of anything.
David Bowie.
Oh!
1889 Dream, to me, was peak David Bowie.
Yeah, that is not a bad suggestion. Does that mean that I'm very attracted to David Bowie?
I mean, why not?
Okay. Why not?
In the beginning, I thought Hop was now a pimp, which, so we moved from slavery to prostitution?
I mean, somebody has to take care of the girls, right? Especially with Jack the Ripper out in the streets.
But I think he was more of a, I'm employing people who might also do some sex work.
It gave me a lot more, I know her just from being around rather than I am her employer vibe, which, phew. But that whole bum dance and cream stick and...
Oh no, it was very cringy to me. I hated that. That was one of the few moments in this episode I did not enjoy because it was very... Ugh. But We go inside and we sit down and we are back in our date. And now I am back in because my two butts are back together. They're very adorable together. And so we have a conversation about humanity in a way. And Dream talks about Lou and he knows everything and he tells us her very tragic backstory. And I honestly do not understand how Dream can know everything that is to know about every single human, and then how he cannot care for humanity.
And this is why I'm saying I think he does care, but he is keeping himself as separated as possible because he doesn't want to get personally involved, because he doesn't want to get hurt.
We're gonna have to put that on a question list if he does care in this time period, because I don't think he does. Why I'm taking so much issue with this is because in this scene, we get the sentence, people are almost always better than you think they are. And that is just like, yes, sometimes they are also so much more horrible and worse than you could ever imagine them to be. But genuinely, most of the time, yeah, people are almost always better than you think they are. And so him knowing all of this, him knowing the depths of human goodness and badness, of their kindness and their evilness and everything. He should be able to see all of this, and it actually should enable him, even after his experience with Roderick, to not fall into this vengeance plot that we then needed Joanna to snap in out of it, to not see every human as a Roderick. So given all this backstory and understanding of humanity that Dream has, makes the first 4 episodes even less understandable to me. So in retrospect, I have even more issue there.
Well, I can't say that I agree with that.
I know. That's fine. As long as someone out there agrees with me, send an email to sandman@trt-podcast.com and tell me at least you agree with me, please.
Or, you know, you can just tell her that she's wrong, as because she is.
No.
No.
But now we're going to break my heart.
Now we get into the fight, and it is a very emotional moment.
Yes!
Because if you thought that Dream doesn't have emotions before now, it is very clearly proven here that that is not the case. Because he is being told by Hob that he's not the outside observer to this experiment, as he is within himself convinced that he is an active participator of this. And he wants to be there because he is enjoying Hobbs's company.
Because he's lonely. And Hobbs straight up tells him that he's lonely. And I'm pretty sure this is what causes Dream to lash out, because there is nothing more hurtful than when someone verbatim names the thing that you are in denial about. So I was very sad.
It is very important for Dream to hear that right now, though, because this is mere, what, 20, 30 years before he gets captured in the cage? So, fairly short amount of time.
That is a good question. I wrote it down.
So, he goes from this interaction into climbing back into his little shell and not wanting to share anything. So it actually makes so much more sense to me now that he left the Dreaming with no concern for Lucien at all, because he was building walls around himself because he was called out for being lonely. Like, no, I'm not lonely. I want to be this way. I'm choosing to be like this. It's not because I don't have any friends. And it feels like he has built up these walls that then motivated him into being even more of a loner than he was up until that point. And that climaxed into the moment where he gets captured. And in his brain, he didn't need anybody else, because he's not lonely.
27 years between this interaction and him being captured. I don't so imagine how much he must have felt when the anniversary date came up and he couldn't go.
I can't even. That's that scene. Anyway, let's fast forward then to 1989, because now we have the first time when Dream doesn't show up.
We start this scene with music. Did you recognize the song?
I recognize the song. I didn't write the name of it.
It's Fine Young Cannibals with She Drives Me Crazy. I have the album. That is why I know this.
It's a very topical song for the era.
She drives me crazy.
Do you know what I have to say? This is the first time I actually find Hob attractive myself.
What? okay. I find him decently hot most of the time.
I mean, he's all right up until this point. And then when I was like, oh, actually, this decade really works for him, then the very ending, what was it, 30 years later, I was like, oh, hot damn. So, you know, but this is the first time we see him, and it comes on the tail of Hop telling Dream, next time we see each other, the only reason you're going to show up is because we're friends.
Right?
And then he gets stood up.
He says, right? And he says that. It was so sad.
He really wants to believe it because he also is lonely.
He's literally an immortal. There's nothing more lonely than an immortal existence. God, I'm so upset.
I'm aware of that, talking off Shadow and Bone. Poor baby Darkling. Anyway.
Yeah, Hop didn't turn into a homicidal maniac.
Well, because he didn't have the power to do that.
Could have amassed specific power. He could have turned into a fucking dictator and everything. Yeah, he could have. So we go back into the bar and we now get the mirroring of the same type of conversations than we had in the first time when Morpheus and Death entered. We get the jokes and we get a discussion and of course we get the hunting for rabbits again. And this is hopeful foreshadowing to something that never happens because Dream never shows up. Because Hop doesn't know that, but we do know that he can't show up because he's imprisoned. And so having Hop wait for Dream, not knowing that Dream is not showing up because he doesn't give a damn, but he's not showing up because he cannot show up, was so heartbreaking.
It is very sad, yeah.
And so Hop keeps on drinking, and 100% he is in love with Dream, and he is heartbroken that Dream didn't show up. But because he is Hop, and I feel like his major personality trait is optimism and perseverance. When he then learns that the pub is going to be teared down and Dream didn't show up, he does not give up, quite the opposite. He ensures that in the future, there is going to be a pub for Dream to find him at.
I know, isn't it so cool? I also love that he clearly is the one who makes the arrow as well.
I'm sorry, it's the gayest thing you can do to buy a fucking pub to make sure that your beau has a place to find you. Hi, hon, I bought you the pub that we always met at just so you would never not know where to find me. If that ain't love, I mean, come on.
It's very cute.
Sorry. Have emotions.
Again, with the scene transitions here, not only we get the glass transitioning into the glass prison, but we also get a close-up on Dream's white naked face turns into reflection on a glass, an actual glass, and that brings us to present, which is really, really well done. So like a double whammy transition. Excellent. But then we also get to see the red arrow pointing towards the new inn. 100% done by Hob, because he wanted to make sure.
Yes, and then he follows the arrow and he goes to the new inn and he opens the door and he looks inside and Hop looks up because he's sitting right there and he was waiting for him.
He's, I'm assuming, doing the books. So, you know, he owns the place.
Yeah, he literally bought this place. And Dream is actually smiling.
I know, this was a very big contender for the hottest moment for Dream.
No, this is too cute to be hot, I'm sorry. This is so sweet.
According to you. But the hotness level of the two of them, when they look at each other and smile, is like through the roof for me.
And then Morpheus goes and he apologizes because it is rude to keep one's friends waiting.
I think that this is a big, big step for Dream at this point because he is opening up to somebody and he is letting somebody in and he's doing it willingly and he's doing it quite obviously and he's doing it with a human as well.
I mean, not a normal vanilla human to be fair, but it's a very, very good first step. And then he sits down and he is genuinely proper smiling at Hob. This is so good. I'm legit tearing up.
But the episode is not over yet.
Yes, because they can't let us end on a high.
I mean, they
still gaming.
End on some sort of a high. I don't know who's high when they were making this last scene. So first of all, we get a song throughout this scene.
See, this one I didn't realize that there was a song.
by Bob Moses and Zhu, and it's called Gasp Desire.
No!
I know. It's shocking. Nice. And what we hear, the lyrics that we hear go, I don't want your desire, I just want to be free.
Aww.
That's what we hear on the episode.
I know that Neil Gaiman wasn't involved with Lucifer, but I find it very curious that in Lucifer, in Good Omens and in The Sandman, music and the choice of music and the lyrics of the chosen music all fits so incredibly well and is so relevant to the stories.
Yeah, I love that people understand how significant something like this can become and that they have people to find the proper thing, proper music that's going to give it justice.
And that they're willing to put in the time and effort to find these pieces and everything. Because like in Good Omens, most of it was relatively easy because the book already referenced some of the music, but both in Lucifer and in The Sandman, I don't think that the source material gave you a lot of that, but it really gives this other level. It is genuinely curious to me that now three Gaiman shows have this or heavy focus on the accompanying music. And I'm quite curious if it's going to continue with the Dead Boy Detectives and the Anansi Boys.
Ooh.
Yeah. But let's go into the scene, which starts with, it is I, Desire.
So they're holding an item.
A hook, right? A fishing hook.
It is a fishing hook, yes. And I want to know, because they are holding the sigil and they say, I have your sigil and now Dream has escaped his cage, but don't worry, I have another plan, whatever.
Our plan has failed, but I have another.
I want to know whose sigil would be a fishing hook, because we see all of the sigils.
We have a book, we have the Ankh, we have a bird-like metal skull. We have an empty board, we have a mirror, we have an empty seemingly box, and we have a colorful smoke or moving snake or something. Like, I couldn't make out what the furthest on the right was. So obviously those are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 boards. So first question, of course, is the hook taken from the empty board or is it taken from the box?
I would say from the empty board.
And so do you know the 7 Ds or do you want to know the 7 Ds?
So let's see. We have Dream, Death, Desire, Despair. I'm assuming Desire and Despair are the twins.
Okay.
And my second assumption would be then that Despair is the owner of the fishing hook. But that is just based on the fact that the twins were particularly happy at the last family dinner or chippery or whatever Death says. And I have chalked it up to the fact that they were glad that Dream wasn't there. Okay, so we have...
So you have Delirium, Desire, Despair, Destiny, Destruction, and Dream in alphabetical order.
I feel like from all of those, I'm not surprised that Dream doesn't really fraternize with them because they all seem very intense and Dream is more...
It makes sense that Death and Dream are the two that get along.
Yeah, because all the other ones feel like they have agenda, while Dream and Death seem to be agendaless to me.
And so if the Ankh wasn't already known as Death's symbol, I would have thought the book would be Death, because you know the Book of Life. I feel like Desire might be the mirror.
Yeah, especially basing it on the way Desire is presented so far.
So we're gonna say Desire. And you already said that the hook was probably from the empty board and is for Despair, which makes sense because like Despair grips you like a barbed hook and it doesn't let you go, you know? So the book is Destiny, the Ankh is Death, the bird like a metal skull is Destruction, the empty board is probably where the fishing hook was taken from and thus it is Despair, the mirror is Desire, the empty box is Dream, and the colorful smoke or moving snake or whatever that on the far right is Delirium. So
look at us go. We're so smart.
And we end this scene, obviously, with the our plan has failed, but don't worry. I have already put other things into motion. So obviously two things. A, is Desire collaborating with the Corinthian? It's my number one question. Or is the Corinthian just capitalizing on the fact that fuckery is happening and is not aware of the bigger things?
I think that there is a very good chance that the Corinthian is being a pawn.
Oh, that Desire uses him.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, good point.
I think that Desire uses the Corinthian without the Corinthian realizing it, which makes the most sense to me. So he's not talking to the Corinthian now. He needs to be talking to one of their siblings.
They are definitely talking to their twin. So that makes a lot of sense. So that is question number one. Question number two is, what is the new plan that has been put in motion? And will Morpheus be able to fight this now that he is more powerful than he has been for eons? And third question, why did they do it in the first place? Why did they want to get Dream imprisoned and out of the way? Because what?
These are all very good questions, and I'm very curious about where they're going to go. But for now, let me just...
take a breath.
I really, really enjoyed this episode. It was a very rough start, not gonna lie. But all in all, it gave us a very good insight to Dream's evolution. So where he is started emotionally, how much has he changed over the millennium? And it gives us a little bit of a better idea which way he might go from here. So I am very much there for it because I love predictability, but not too much of it. I want to know a general direction so I can still be surprised. And nobody's surprised by that. I really enjoyed that the episode was split in two as well, because the way it was structured, it really, really worked for me. And the whole bit with Desire at the end, oh my God. I thought at the beginning of that scene that it's some sort of a weird, fancy Statue of Liberty. And the visual of that scene was absolutely incredible. And I am extremely intrigued. There is so many questions that have been asked by us throughout covering this episode. And I love that because there's still plenty of time to get answers for them. And we don't need everything to be simple, because a lot of things that has happened so far were very straightforward and very easy. Let's face it. I understand why this has to be done, because you have to introduce your characters and everything. But we're now finally getting into the thick of it, and I am really enjoying this.
So my first reaction after this episode was, what? Also, you said we still have a lot of time to now properly explore all of this. Well, we are now at the halfway mark. This was episode 6, and the season 1 has 12 episodes, if I remember it correctly. So exactly halfway mark, which also is the perfect moment to break all of this wide open. I have so many questions. I've already asked some of them. We will see if I repeat myself. But aside from so many questions that I ask, this episode feels so different tonally from the previous 5 episodes. It kind of felt like watching a different show. And I am very curious how this will be done in the next one. Will we go back to the vibe of the first 5 episodes? Is this our new normal? Are we getting something completely different because now new fuckery is going to happen? Like, even that leads just to more questions. So whatever questions. Obviously, who is the prodigal? That is really important. Who is the other twin? Are you right or are you wrong? Why was this Desire's plan all along? And my most important question that I really hope people will send mails and messages in, am I the only one aside from Vero shipping Hop and Dream? Because I did do a very quick Google search and I didn't find any obvious ship for it. So tell me, why are we the only one shipping it? And if we're not, send me fanfic. More importantly, though, than all of this, obviously, is who is Mad Hattie and when will we learn more about her? Finally, for the first time since we started doing this series, I cannot wait for the next episode. I am fully arrived in this. I am obsessed. Dream finally has my love, though I still think that he looks very arrogant. And even though Vero does not enjoy my visual parallels I draw, but I have arrived, so bring it on. And with this, all that is left is to say thank you for listening to us rambling on. If you want to hear more of our rambling, there are hours upon hours upon hours of bonus content for our wonderful patrons over at patreon.com/TIOTpodcast. Do check it out and do support us if you can.
We have not only done The Sandman, but we have covered multiple other shows and books and movies in the past. So please, if you like the works of Neil Gaiman, check them out. And if you have any opinions whatsoever, please send us an email to thesandman@taot-podcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, and Patreon.
And if you want to do us a solid, then please do write us a loving review over on iTunes. Do not underestimate how much it helps. It will make us appreciate you. It will make you our friend. And don't we all need more friends?
Speaking of friends, please do recommend us to your friend if you are enjoying this, because it is one of the best ways to grow a podcast, word of mouth. So thank you so much for listening today. And until next time,
bye!